Welcome to Good Areas Live. This is a Wagon Wheel podcast, the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket. Anyway, you get the idea. If you are in the YouTube and you can always do a chat after that last game that just finished. I had to wait. I was going to broadcast and I was like, I suppose I have to watch this last over. What was Hardik Pandya and Sky doing? They should have taken that to a super over. Don't throw the ball that hard. Run to the stumps. That's a run out. Anyway. So if you have a super chat that you want to ask, obviously pop it into the group here and we'll have a look at it. But if not, the best way to ask questions is, as always, on Patreon, where you can get them in earlier. So you can find Good Areas podcasts. And with that, Neil has asked the question, which is, I get the impression that Bill O'Reilly would have been an effective T20 bowler. What do you think? I think he would have been unplayable T20 bowler. I think a very, very fast leg spinner with a hard to play wrong-un, incredibly accurate as well. Probably bowled a little bit, maybe a cross between Chandrasekhar and Anil Kumble. I suppose a little bits of Richie Beno in his bowling as well. I think he would have been a fantastic bowler. Is there a case that suggests he's the second best leg spinner of all time? So we talked about this recently when we were looking at the best spinner of all time. The problem with O'Reilly's case is just that he hasn't even taken 150 wickets. You know, 200 is really where we want to start looking at that. I mean, it's a bit unfair. If you were to bring it down, and obviously the war played a big part in it, if you were to bring it down a little bit, things would change and he goes back up. But look, he's one of the greatest bowlers of all time and absolutely dominated his era, which is kind of what you're supposed to do, right? That's what I would aim to do anyway. I would fail, but that's what I'd aim to do. Lemon says, would Pat Cummins' record be significantly better if he opened the bowling rather than bowling first change in tests? Yeah, I think so. I think there is a tax on bowling first change. I've talked about it before. When it comes to Joel Garner, I did a whole video on Neil Wagner as well. You don't get the new ball. You don't get the new ball bust, right? Bust, boom, boom, bust. I'm just making noises now. I definitely think there is an element of that, that we would see him be even better if he was able to do that. So, that's kind of the gig though, right? Like if you have two other bowlers who need the new ball, I'm trying to think of some other bowlers in the history of the game. Garner, Morkel, Wagner. I think of some others. Some of the West Indians probably would have rotated through that position as well, not just Garner. That's where you end up. Connor says, Mumbai have been maxing out on pace strike bowlers over the last few rounds. Really high risk, high reward. The gamble makes sense given they were bottom of the table early on. If they cement a top four space, should they go with extra defensive option in Santner? Or is Bumrah's econ enough to buy them an extra middle order hitter like Bosch? I think they've always liked strike bowling. I think their analytics tell them that strike bowling is a big thing. If you go back to Mitch McLenaghan, you know, they've liked the left arm. They went with someone like Berendorf as well. You know, like that, they've kind of always leaned towards that. I'm not too worried about defensive or attacking bowlers from that perspective. I'm more looking at what kind of a batting lineup and bowling lineup do you have. So if you have an uber aggressive batting lineup, like the Sunrisers, you could probably get away with a pretty good defensive bowling lineup, right? If you've got a par total, if you've got like a Gujarat batting lineup, you probably don't want a defensive bowling lineup, right? You probably want some people who can take wickets, right? And it's that's the kind of matching I'm looking at. I'm not sure about Bosch in the playoffs. I'm not sure they need Bosch in the playoffs. But yeah, Bumrah buys a lot of extra ability and they're probably, well, a bowler short is fair, all things considered with that team. MF Jim says, this year seems really big for English Test cricket. What happens if it ends like 2013, 2014? Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I was thinking about this, MF Jim, not just for the men, but for the women. You know, the women are hosting a World Cup. They're coming off a pretty disappointing period of their cricket. The men are still talking about entertainment when a lot of the English cricket fans are like, what about winning a game? The basketball hasn't been as successful of recent times. I kind of feel like both the men's and women's English sides just need to play better cricket. And it could finish with a 13-14 for the men. You're right. And, you know, the England women could end up being disappointing in two World Cups back-to-back and the second one at home. I know that's not quite this year, but it's all in the same in the same area. So, yeah, it's it is a difficult one. I don't think the Australian team's, like, firing at the moment. I think they played some good cricket against India, but there's some definite weaknesses in that side as well. But yeah, it could be worse than 13-14, MF Gym, because they could lose. Well, they should beat Zimbabwe, but Zimbabwe have bowlers. You always, if you want to go up against a crap team, you always want to go up a crap team with a crap team that doesn't have good bowlers. And then you've got India, who I think should be slight favourites for that series, followed by the Ashes. Like, it's, you know, there's a lot that can go. There's a lot of banana peels that can go wrong there. My Wi-Fi go. Oh, it's the same thing when my computer just keeps defaulting for the wrong Wi-Fi. Sorry about that, everyone. I was running back in to record this podcast, so I didn't get my chance to do my full Ethernet cables and everything else that I get to put on. The foxes haven't bitten the Ethernet cables, at least. All right. American Wicket says, would Blessing Mazrumbani start for any other full nation sides right now? Bangladesh has got a pretty good pace bowling attack, but he'd certainly be in and around it. The West Indies, I think they'd be looking at someone like Blessing. I think he'd be quite handy there. Sri Lanka probably don't have another bowler of his height, so I could see how he would be of use to them. Certainly Ireland, again, I would have thought. So yeah, there's quite a few others. He'd certainly be in the conversation. I think he'd be in the conversation for some better teams too. There just aren't many 6'10" bowlers around, right? And he's skillful. He's brilliant with the new ball. If you have a hole in your side where you need that kind of a bowler, I'm trying to think of a New Zealand kind of had new ball bowlers at the moment. South Africa don't need anyone that tall. He'd be there and thereabouts for England, wouldn't he? I mean, they don't have obvious bowlers that are so much better than him that he wouldn't play. So yeah, probably in Pakistan, right? Again, I think there's quite a few teams. I don't know if he'd be automatic in all those players. But yeah, Rob says, in your opinion, which fast bowler has the most stylish action? Justify your decision if it's not Alan Donald. Yeah, I think Alan Donald had a lot. I always said that Brett Lee had a sort of like a, almost like a femininity in his, like it's so smooth. And so I think I once wrote that it was like an office worker walking around you really quickly after she jumps off the train. Like, that's how I always felt about Brett Lee. There's something very smooth about that. I think if there's anyone else, stylish. I'm trying to think. I mean, the kind of actions I like are probably stylish in a different way. Like, I love Sean Tate's action because it's kind of, you know, a little bit wild. Trying to think of some of the older actions that are. Yeah, because I love Curtly Ambrose and Wasim Akram, and I don't know if I'd call them stylish, but I really enjoyed that. Where would you go with like Merv Hughes' prancing polar bear style as well? Like Srisanth, is that another stylish one? I probably think it is. Oops, sorry. Yeah, so there's probably a few different stylish ones out there. But yeah, Alan Donald's definitely, you know, towards the top. Satchmo says, the DRS make it extremely difficult to compare spinners' records between eras? Ramadan's career, for example, was badly affected by players sticking their front pad down the wicket to off cutters, to even straight ones, and getting the umpire's benefit. Yeah, but that's the game, Satchmo. You have to be better than the era that you're in. Right? We're not suddenly beset by spinners. Spinners haven't suddenly taken over the game since DRS has come in. It's changed the way they've bowled. Spinners would often try and get stumpings. Very rare for a spinner to try and get a stumping now, unless there's a batter who's desperate to come down the wicket or slog or has already moved down. You used to bowl a lot more for caught at slip and, you know, trying to get edges and bat pads and stuff. Again, that's much rarer now. You bowl at the stumps, you try and spin it, and you hope that you're a chance of getting a bowled, an LB, and maybe even an inside or an outside edge as well. You're trying to keep everything in play. It's completely different, but that's the same for everything. I mean, you talk about Sonny Rabideau. Well, he started bowling on covered wicket. So the bowlers before him had a bigger advantage again. I definitely think there's a period from the late 70s through to the 90s where spinners were really disadvantaged. You can look at the numbers. And I don't think it's Ramadan's era. I think it's really after that, because I think there's still a little bit of uncovered wickets and the wickets are still a little bit rougher. They get, you get a point where they're sort of, everything is aimed towards pace bowling outside of Asia and Asian conditions at that point. And, you know, Abdul Qadir averaged, what, 32, 33 with the ball, and he was miles ahead of everyone else as well. So I definitely think that there is that. But that's the gig, Sashmo, right? That's, you know, Victor Trumper and WG Grace were disadvantaged. Bradman was disadvantaged, right? You know, you have to play in the era that you're playing it. Naveen says, which players should CSK be targeting in the mini auction to strengthen their side, and which players should they let go? I think it's a bit hard to give you that, Naveen, because we have to see what other players are going to be available and how this is all going to shake loose. The way I look at it is, that's not the question I would be trying to answer. If I'm working for CSK, first thing I would be doing is, do we need a complete reboot from top to bottom? Is there any point in Doni coming back? Is there any point in Fleming coming back? Do we need a different general manager? Do we need a scouting network? Do we need an analysis team? All these different things, right? That's where I would be looking at it. Secondly, how are we going to try and win cricket matches? Are we going to try and win by our batting teams? Because they've got, what, Matre, Brevis. Am I missing someone else? Guy Quad. So is there a style that matches those three guys? Flat pitches, spinning wickets, seam bowling wickets, whatever that may be that they can do. Or are they trying to get par scores, right? And they're trying to, load up on, because they've got the three really good bowlers in Pathirana, Noor Ahmed, and Khalil Ahmed. Did I say Noor Ahmed? Anyway, Noor. So I think you've got that sort of that core six, and you throw Jadeja in there, Shivam Dubey, so it might still be the spin thing. That's what you do, Naveen. You go, let's say you're running the franchise and you're the director of cricket. The first question is, are we going to go with the same captain, right? So with the same coach, once you've decided you're going to go with the same coach, then Stephen Fleming has to have a conversation with everyone and be like, I think we need to change our ways and we need to go in a new direction. Okay, great. So we've decided on a new direction or a new coach and maybe both, right? Now, how do we make that work? Can we make our home wicket work for that? What grounds is that going to help on next year? What players are possibly going to be free, available around the edges, right, to be able to get that? Because you can't make massive changes this first year. So maybe someone like Deshpande might be let go of, right? I'm trying to think of someone else who's had a bad year, another Indian player. Might get some other players like that have been let go of that you're like, actually, we can recycle them and we can make them work better here or whatever. That's what you do. You work out what is the best way to win for you, given your conditions and the players that you have, and then you try and build from there. A person says, what limits associate nations in developing fast-paced bowling? What would they need to develop more fast-paced bowlers? For context, I took the 10 fastest-paced bowlers by wickets taken in the CWC L2, and none were listed in cricket as fast. Only two were listed as fast medium, two as medium fast, and the rest just medium. So either it's a labeling issue on cricket first part, or all eight of the top associate nations can't develop. So firstly, the cricket info ratings are not done on Hawkeye. They are and they're quite often done when players are in under-19s cricket, and they're really wildly inaccurate. So I would never look at those. Maybe when a player's been playing top level cricket for a few years, they're usually updated. But when you're looking at associate players, I wouldn't even know at Cricket Info who follows associate cricket. Now, Peter Della Penna doesn't work for Cricket Info anymore, right? The Dutch team had no problem finding fast bowlers. If you look at the history of cricket, finding fast bowlers usually takes a long time to develop, right? We didn't even always have fast bowlers in cricket. New teams usually struggle to find fast bowlers. It's over a period of time that, Pakistan is quite famous for fast bowlers, and it took them a while, right? West Indies, Australia are probably two outliers there. South Africa weren't famous for fast bowlers until after World War II. They had a couple, but they weren't fast. So South Africa hasn't always produced fast bowlers. I kind of think with top-end batting talent, and we're talking about top-end batting talent, so top 50 of all time, art of batting, that sort of thing, and really fast bowlers, I think it takes a cricket community, over a while to be able to get those two things. I think you can get outliers with swing bowlers and skillful bowlers and decent batters and everything else. But I think the real outliers at the top, like if you put Steve Tokolo from Kenya into a proper system, I think there is every chance that, he would have been, or Dave Houghton from Zimbabwe, you can pick a sort of a random associate player from that level. I actually think they would have been very, very highly rated players, right? But once the community builds, you do end up with Andy Flower after Dave Houghton, right? Like there is an element of that happening. And I think it's the same with fast bowling. It's the same with women's bowling. I don't think we've always encouraged people to bowl as fast as they can. And if you look at the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a lot of sports science, a lot of biomechanics, a lot of, pushing people to bowl as fast as possible. None of that is in associate cricket either. So I think there's a few different elements really. Let me have a quick break here. You're on the Wagon Wheel podcast, and this is the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket. But I just answered some, so I'll have a break.
If you need a VPN, go Nord. Use nordvpn.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months, plus gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. Protect your computer like a blocker protects the stumps with NordVPN today.
All right, welcome back. Neil says, some successful franchise T20 captains like Emma Stoney and Gambier have said that they never believed in data analytics. Do some players just instinctively read the game so well that they don't see its importance, assuming it's far more helpful tool in T20 than, say, test? A, we're at the early stages of data, so yeah, I think you could win a title without data analysis if you have really smart people working for you. But you do need really smart people. I think it's a safety net, and it's also an extra tool, so it's silly for you not to use it. B, Dhoni, whether he understands data analytics or not, plays in a way that suggests he already has taken that information in, right? Gambier wants left-right combinations all the way through. Again, where does that come from, right? These are the sorts of things that may become slightly more, you know, there are some people who work these things out a little bit and some who don't. You would be silly if you're a franchise or a coach now and you are not looking at this as a tool. Like, I'm sorry, you would just be silly. You may not be left behind. You may be really smart at man management. You may be really smart at reading the game naturally. And there are plenty of people like that out there. Use every tool. Data analysis is just another tool. And, you know, I really worry about people who say things like this. This is a bit like people who say cricketers don't need to be fit. Well, there are lots of cricketers who haven't been fit, but surely your team is going to be better if you're fitter than the opposition and you're of an equal level of talent, right? Like, why would you not use data analysis? It can do so many different things that you can't do with your human eye. You can't go back. MS Dhoni, when he's captaining in a side, cannot physically remember every single strength and weakness of a player if he's never gone up against them before. Why not use data analysis in that case? Because he's only going to need to look at the smallest amount of data, or, you know, one graph or a couple of videos to be able to work that out. I don't see what the point of that is. I just feel like there's a lot of older cricketers who didn't grow up with it and they've done quite well and they're like, oh, I don't need it. Isn't the idea to improve every day? William says, what are your thoughts on the ECB banning trans women from competition? So I think, and William, I could be wrong on this. I think because I don't follow other sports, but I talked to someone about it the other day, and it's obviously linked back to the Supreme Court decision that happened in the UK, which was an abomination of the English government not to get involved with that, to let it go to Supreme Court. I'm not even going to get into the whole toilets thing and everything, because it's just like, there's so many flaws in the arguments of the people who don't like, I mean, just come out and say you don't like trans people. So many people who seem to have very stringent views on women's sport and haven't seen them commenting too much on Heather Knight, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, fuck off. I think we have to understand, this is not something that can be legislated away in the way that I think people want it to be legislated away. There are definite advantages that some athletes have if they are male transitioning to women, because they might have gone through puberty, they might have had a growth spurt, you know, all these different things. But the science, it also says that in some cases there isn't. And what about, you know, when we had Danielle from Canada, when she was going through, she's 5'7". She's actually shorter than the vast majority of professional women's cricketers, right? She doesn't have that natural advantage. Does she have advantages in other areas? Okay, let's test it. That's what she already had to go through all that. I just think it's a bit of a step backwards. And also, I do think it's a misunderstanding of sport. I also think it's a misunderstanding of male versus female sport. I've said this before, and I've been saying this for over a decade, that there is this right-wing ideal that there are men and there are women, right? And I think it was an English politician who was caught out with this recently when it might have been an American politician was caught out about this when he was asked about intersex people. And he didn't even know what it was. We have athletes that are intersex before. That have, you know, that have performed as men, performed as women, that don't always know that they are a mix of both until years later. In some cases, you know, I think there was an autopsy on a famous sprinter who, you know, would never have known that they were intersex, right? Like, it just wasn't a thing that they would have been aware of. So that's why I think it's a much more nuanced conversation. We're not ready for it, because realistically, what is happening is that trans athletes are being used by culture wars for people to win cheap points in sports that they don't even follow in the first place, right? That they're not involved at. A lot of the people that I've ever dealt with in women's cricket have been really pro-trans, right? And trans rights and allies, right? And yet people who don't go to women's cricket matches seem very worried about 6'10" bowlers coming in and bouncing everyone, right? The most important thing that you ever need to know about the trans issue is these people who don't follow women's sport and get really upset about this, always talk about the LeBron James argument. What if LeBron James wanted to go and become a woman and go and play women's basketball? People don't transition to be successful in women's sport. And the reason they don't is it's always been hard to be a trans athlete and actually compete at top level women's sport. It's a nonsense argument, right? It doesn't make any sense at all. And there are so many issues with this all the way through. It's not for me, but I just think sport needs to grow up. There aren't two sexes. I'm sorry. We didn't know when the Olympics started, 130 years ago, when the modern Olympics started, we didn't know that there wasn't just two sexes. We didn't understand enough about intersex. We didn't have trans people who could get medicine and operations and change. Sport has to change because guess what? The world has changed. Rudra says, Delhi and Punjab have the all-time worst records of active IPL teams. Which of them has the better all-time 11? Off the top of my head, I'm just going to go Delhi. But I can't remember like all the players who played for those two teams over, 17, 18 years? But I'm going to go Delhi. PJ says, have recently learned about David Hooks. Seems like he had everything going for him at one stage, including looks. There was a lot of talk about his looks. Like, I think he was a good looking guy. I don't think he was like a model or anything. It's funny, when I was doing the documentary on the World Series cricket, everything was just about how good looking David Hooks was. And of course, I put it in there as well, because that's the narrative at this point. He never managed to fulfill his potential and had an unfortunate ending. What is his legacy in Australia today, or is he largely forgotten? He's very well known in cricket circles. He also went on to have quite a good media career. Look, I think there are a lot of people who kind of think that with David Hooks, maybe the hit in the head from Andy Roberts in the World Series cricket game played a part. I've never done a deep dive to look at what his first class record was before and after that happened. There's some interesting stuff about his record. I'm just looking it up now. Like in List A cricket, he played 82 games, half of those were ODIs, and he never made any runs. And yet he was an incredibly naturally attacking player. I wonder if he was a very good player with maybe a couple of flaws. He was a very smart player. He obviously went on to be a coach and everything. He's had a very lasting impact on Victorian and South Australian cricket. South Australian cricket since David Hooks hasn't really been a major part of, the national discussion on cricket. So maybe some of his legacy has dulled a little bit there. He's still very highly regarded in Victoria. I don't know if I've ever told this story before, but I actually talked to David Hooks on the day he passed away. So for those who don't know, he came out of a bar, a nightclub, and got in an altercation with the bouncer who hit him, and he died later that night. But weirdly, I remember he was obsessed with like medium paces, and he used to walk laps around the ground. And there's like 500 of us in the ground, right, watching a Victorian game. And I just remember we had this ridiculous attack of like Ian Harvey, John Moss, Andrew McDonald. Was it Jason Backer might have been there? So many medium paces, right? And he came around the boundary and he was in front of me, and I said something along the lines, "You think you got enough medium paces there, Hooksy?" And he sort of looked back at me and he goes, "We'll be okay." And of course, they came back to win that game, which I think they were massively out of. So look, he was a big media person as well. So I think within the game, he's quite highly regarded. But because he didn't go on to be a star test player or an ODI player, he's probably not going to be remembered in the same way. But he was a fantastic player. I think most people who saw him would agree on that. What did Tony Gregg call him? Another Australian rubbish left-hander? I think I got that right. Sandeep says, have you had the chance to see Digvesh bowling closely? Can you please explain his bowling techniques specifically that made him very hard to score runs off? So we just did a whole podcast on this, Sandeep. Essentially, he's using a bunch of different variations of the carom ball. I think he's got a knuckle ball as well. There's another delivery. Does he use that's the sort of the finger wrong, and I think occasionally. But he's doing what Chakravarti used to do. He's doing what Narayan does. He's doing what Tikshana does, what Majib does. They're bowling very fast onto a spot on the pitch where you can't use your feet. And he's deceiving people because they're not picking him out of his hand. And he can move the ball in either direction, which means it's very hard to line him up. You can't just hit him straight down the ground because you're not sure where it's going. He's bowling at a length that it's hard to sort of play a flat bat shot to. That's the modern style. Sandeep says, beside the established test playing nations, which other countries' rising cricket culture and talent in the global T20 league circuit are you most excited for? I mean, Nepal is the most exciting team, aren't they? Because they have dynamic players. They have a real cricket culture there, you know, very passionate about it. They have some bad administration and some issues. And obviously, you know, I've talked to their former captain about this on a podcast before. Like, there are issues within Nepal, but I think they're one of the more exciting developing countries. I'm really excited for Japan because I kind of can see why Japan would get into cricket. I suppose USA, just because of the market, and Canada really should probably be better than they are as well. They would be the four. And Papua New Guinea, you know, one of the best fielding teams in the world, really haven't. I think they've got to make the cricket slightly wider in Papua New Guinea than it is at the moment. But, you know, having watched them play, they seem to get it, and they're building a good community there. So I suppose those are some of the teams you'd be keeping an eye on. Sachmo says, who is Australia's best ever bowler who mainly bowled as the third seamer in the attack? Well, do you count Pat Cummins as that, Sachmo, is the question. Because it's Pat Cummins is the best first-change Australian bowler that I can think of. Because if you look back at most of the great Australian bowling pairs, they've been pairs. Well, because I just said the word pairs. I suppose you could put Brett Lee in that as well. I think Brett Lee is very underrated and played in a very tough era for bowlers. And I think we've done those numbers before. His numbers really hold up when you adjust for the pitches he played on and in the era he played in. But Pat Cummins is obviously a better bowler than Brett Lee. I'm trying to think of another great long-term sort of first change bowler. Yeah. I would have thought it's Pat Cummins. And if it's not Pat Cummins, is it like because you're saying as the third seamer, would you say that Mitchell Starc is the third seamer? And I'd still, you know, and Mitchell Starc and Brett Lee then are a lot closer to each other, I think, at that point. All right, let us take another break here on the Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back shortly with more shenanigans.
From Virat Kohli's MCG 6 against Pakistan to Bumrah's stump-destroying Yorker to Ollie Pope, incredible things happen on the cricket ground. We also get iconic lines off it, like Siraj saying, I only believe in Jesse Bhai. There are so many incredible moments that cricket fans just never forget. And now you can wear them on your chest. Free Hit Gear has launched a line of amazing t-shirts and hoodie designs. Passionate fans in India can order through their website, freehitgear.com, while fans abroad can use Free Hit Gear on the Etsy store to have items delivered to them. Order now with the code GOODAREAS, or one word, to get a limited time 15% discount, and you can wear a t-shirt like this one right here.
All right, welcome back. Ankush says, well, this is a question. How does one predict the IPL? In an ICC tournament, three of the top favourites usually make it through, even though a lot of the tournaments have been won by a few teams, CSK and Mumbai. No one can make an actual informed guess of who will do well in any particular season. I think it's a lot easier, Ankush, later in the cycle. It's hard in the cycle because players are, you're looking at new formations, and we don't even know exactly what players are going to be in 11s and all sorts of things. So I think it's probably easier later in the cycle than it is earlier. But the truth is that there isn't as much between franchise teams as there quite often is in a World Cup, as you said, right? There is a clear delineation in talent between the teams. If you look at the betting odds, it's really clear. So that's probably pretty common in a lot of different sports around the rest of the world. The second thing is that these, especially in T20 cricket, these are short tournaments, and so form plays a very, very big part. You say football leagues around the world don't see as many ups and downs. Football is a sport where more often than not, you get the result pretty close. Like, the best team should win a higher percentage of games than they would in T20 cricket. On top of that, you know, you're playing, what, double? I should know this. How many matches in the English Premier League per team? They play 38 matches. So again, if the Sunrisers played all year, I was pretty sure that Mumbai, KKR and Sunrisers, out of the three of them, at least one of them was going to make a run. Probably Mumbai, based on the first part of the season. But I still thought that KKR had a chance of doing it. If this was a 28 or 38 game season, I wouldn't have been surprised if KKR or Sunrisers got their act together. You know, if Travis Head and Abhishek Sharma had 10 games of playing well and Heinrich Klassen could go back to batting from the 10th over rather than the 5th over, right? I wouldn't see that. But yeah, they are a bit more random. They are a bit more even, I think, is also part of it. But that's something you see quite right across a lot of T20 franchise leagues as well at the moment, because we don't have a lot of sort of longer planning. But there's not the infrastructure around it. I just think there's a lot of sort of randomness that is built into the way it goes about. Lemon says, do you think eventually we will see spinners with 24 variations? They can bowl in a T20 match, a different ball each time. Yeah, I mean, it's probably a ways off. But, you know, Benny Howland used to say that he had, 40 slower balls, right? Like, there's traditional wrong-un, little fingers wrong-un, finger wrong-un. So there's three wrong-uns off the top of my head. And I think there's a fourth one that I'm not thinking of at the moment, right? You have, again, you have a traditional leg spinner. You can then bowl like sort of a two-finger leg spinner that's more like a leg cutter. We see Varun Chakravarti bowl that one sometimes. You can bowl a leg spinner with more topspin. So there's six balls, right? Flipper, you've got a couple of different variations that also go straight. So like the slider would be one. You've got the one that sort of looks like it's, you know, that drifts but doesn't spin, which is that sort of Joe Denley ball, I suppose, where you get the seam. We're up to 9 on wrist spin already. What else can we add to wrist spin? Faster ball is 10. Then if you added in off cutter, off spinner, arm ball, undercutter, UFO ball, knuckle ball, split finger, spinner. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes. The thing is, Lemon, it's so hard to be a perfect at each one of those balls. And that was what Benny Howell always said. He's like, yeah, I can bowl 40 slow balls, but I can't bowl 40 slow balls in a game, right? I probably have like 4 that are my go-to, 2 that I can use if I really think that they'll, you know, that I can sort of experiment with occasionally. A couple of others that I'm working on that I'm hoping that will be good in the future. It's very hard. You know, most baseball pitchers, there's lots of different baseball pitches that you can throw. Most baseball pitchers have 1 or 2, right? You know, maybe 2 is probably the median number that a baseball pitcher would have. But you probably have some pitchers who can throw 4 or 5 and some that can throw 1. MF Jim says, what are some factors that lead you to decide on an era, such as the wobble seam or batting dominant ones? And are there any unknown ones we should know? I mean, I would say they're pretty subjective. And I did a podcast with Simon Hughes, and you know, he was sort of mixing them up a little bit more than I would in a slightly different way, but we were both talking about the same kind of thing. So they're very subjective. Like, there does seem to be a big difference between 90s batting and 2000s batting that almost seems to happen straight away, so that's really easy. Whereas the wobble ball era really starts midway through 2017. That's a bit messier, right? And then we still think the wobble ball era is still the predominant delivery. But you could also call this from 2003 to now, you could also call this the DRS era, right? So there are many different, or Hawkeye era maybe, rather than DRS, but either or, right? You know, when the umpires started retraining themselves. So, you know, I think you really look at that. I think I've named most of them. They're certainly all in the book. The book is called The Art of Batting, available in 2 days. But yeah, I think you kind of have what I would call the cow shit pitches. Then you have the sort of the early muck spreading pitches. You then have the very flat pitches start happening in the 1920s. And that is obviously the uncovered era. And we start to have people who start to make masses of amounts of runs. The 1950s is kind of the dead ball era. It's very hard to get a wicket. It's very hard to score any runs. We then start to come into the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, which is probably now thought of as sort of the covered wicket era, when, you know, the teams who used to bowl a lot of spin in the West stop bowling as much spin. Pace bowling eventually takes over. Seam bowling eventually takes over, you know, so you could have that as a big long one, but you could also chop that up into probably the 60s and 70s is a transitional period. And then the 80s is when the seam bowling and pace and out and out pace takes over and everything else. So there's a few different ways of looking at all that. And you could throw in micro ones as well. There's ones about the LBW law, you know, the birth of pad play, the birth of footwork, you know, I think there's lots of micro ones that you could throw in at any stage. There's a period at the end of the 1970s when the batting averages just drops for like 2 years. And some of that has to be World Series cricket related, but doesn't really make sense because a lot of the World Series cricket bowlers would have not been there as well. Anyway, Rob says, for a typical player in the IPL, how much of their auction price does the player typically receive? Is it prorated on availability or selection, or do they get the full amount and then bonuses for appearances? I think you need to be available for every game. And if you're not available for every game, then it's prorated. Obviously, when you say their full amount, there's taxes, there's agents, maybe managers as well. So they don't always get that. I think there was something earlier on in the IPL that wasn't quite as efficient, which was if you didn't play, you didn't get your money. And I don't think that's, I haven't looked at the regulations in a while, Rob, but I don't think that stuck around very much. But yeah, and then there are also some boards that take a percentage of your IPL wage. And I don't know if that's still happening, but it certainly, I want to say the England team, the England counties had that for a while. I don't think anyone else has had it unless New Zealand had it as well. So you had to do a kickback to your board as well, your domestic board. There's a lot of weird regulations. The most important thing to know really, Robbie, is that I think more or less you receive your full whack if you are available for selection. And someone might be able to correct me on that, but that's the last I remember of it. Robbie might know a little bit more as he's been involved in it more. I haven't had to be involved in it since 2018, so I haven't been working on that as much. We've already had that one. Rudra says, has Jofra Archer ever been part of a particularly functional team since the 2019 World Cup? And how might that affect his motivation and confidence? I mean, he's been involved with England, so they've been functioning. He was around with Mumbai. You know, it wasn't a good team and he didn't play. I think there's just, you know, Jofra Archer is somewhere between an England player and a freelance player. And he's not the only one in the world. There's a lot of players kind of on that verge, right? And so it is probably a little bit trickier for him. I don't know if it would affect his confidence or his motivation. I've only met Jofra like once or twice and he's very shy. So he's not the sort of person who would probably open up about this, but I get the feeling he's a pretty driven dude. And I just think that he's quite, you know, he knows what he wants to get out of his career. I don't think he struggles with motivation at all. He might struggle for motivation with, you know, to be inspired to bowl the next ball, because he's maybe a different sort of person in that perspective. But I don't think he struggles to be motivated for his career. And as far as confidence, you know, one good bouncer could change things. PJ says, even though Cricinfo has shat the bed the last 5 years or so, it's coming in strong. I can't think of one thing that CricBuzz does better. CricBuzz seems like such an inferior product. How exactly did they become so popular? The story of CricBuzz is fascinating. Essentially, what happened was ESPN were asleep at the wheel with Cricinfo, and they didn't realize that. I think this is a lot to do with gambling. People just wanted scores quicker and quicker. And so it became a very known thing within cricket that CricBuzz had a quicker server than Cricinfo. Also, CricBuzz doesn't do as much, right? The problem with Cricinfo is that they haven't really worked out a way to handle being the global cover of cricket. CricBuzz isn't the global cover of cricket. They don't have, as far as I'm aware, they don't have a full-time English writer. They don't have writers right around the world. They don't even have that many writers. I remember when they offered me a job as an editor at one stage, and I was like, who are your writers? And they didn't give me a very long list. They just gave me like a couple of names. I found them very bizarre. You know, and I've obviously got a million stories about moaning about Cricinfo because I've worked for them for almost a decade, so I could match them. But yeah, I found CricBuzz very bizarre, but it was mostly about the service. Then they nailed the app. And again, there's just so much information on Cricinfo that I don't think they've ever quite nailed the app. CricBuzz is more of a scoring platform, whereas I think Cricinfo is much more of an editorial and a scoring platform. Cricinfo is run by a proper long-form magazine, editor, right? Like, it's, so it's a very different situation to what Crick Buzz is. Crick Buzz also went after the parochial Indian audience. I think a few years ago, they stopped covering the PSL. I think they then came back and did it again, did they? I can't remember if they did. But, you know, they're much more, and you know, Crick Info's not, even now when it gets abused for being too Indian, like I worked there for a long time, it wasn't too Indian. Do you know what I mean? It was, there were other issues with Crick Info that I think you could have slapped it on a lot more. And that's changed a little bit since I've left. Whereas Crick Buzz, and these are what Crick Buzz people tell me, was set up to be a much more patriotic. Crick Buzz is not very well known around the world. It shocks me now because I know how big it is. And like, I'll talk to people like they'll know what it is. And people just sort of look at me like, going, oh, we have no idea what you're talking about. Globally, Crick Info, so much bigger, such a bigger brand. Probably still, even though that Crick Buzz has, I want to say about 25 million more users, but I'm just guessing. I haven't looked at the numbers in a while. I would say that Crick Info is probably still worth about the same, if not more, just because of the global reach that it has. And also the amount of time spent on a page for Crick Info is a lot more. The problem with Crick Buzz is it could be done so much better. I don't understand why everything always seems to be done on the cheap and nasty. Like the hiring process, when they came to me for a job, I mean, I've never been involved with something so, and I've worked in cricket. It was so chaotic and so spasmodic. And they offered me one job and I was like, okay, that's fine. And then they came back and offered me another job and it didn't make any sense, the second job. And then I asked about questions. And at that stage, we were doing really well with the podcast network and the videos. And I was like, well, what's going to happen with videos and podcasts? And they're like, oh, we don't want you to do that. What? You want me just to do words? When I spent the last 2 years commentating and setting up a YouTube page? This seemed like everything with Crick Buzz just seems so random. Crick Info's problem is that it needed a complete overhaul probably about 6 years ago, and it's had a lot of redesigns. I'm not sure you can redesign. I don't think redesigns are the problem with Crick Info. I think the problem with Crick Info is that it's trying to cover too much in a bad way, and it needs to, I would strip Crick Info back and start again. I would change the way they cover cricket completely. Not the scoring or anything like that, but certainly from the editorial stuff and what ends up on the website and everything else. That is what I would be doing with Crick Info. But yeah, I could go on for hours about Crick Info and Crick Buzz. I think they're really fascinating. But that's why, you know, I think there's three or four massive holes in the market of people just doing cricket content better. I could think of four businesses at the moment that you could do where you could take a serious chunk out of them, out of those two companies, just because they're missing open goals. And in some cases, I don't think they could ever even kick the goals themselves. They're so sort of, you know, Crick Info, I just don't know how you untangle Crick Info. It was too big and it got so big. And then it sort of got clumped together with this sort of old school way of covering, of being in the media. It just needs a complete and utter reshape. And Crick Buzz needs proper editorial content. People have to take Crick Buzz seriously. It's ridiculous how much it's laughed at within the game. And there's no reason for it to be like that. It must be making money. It's worth a ton of money. I just think it's really badly organized. Yeah.
Remember that cricket is a funny game. 100 years before we protected our head, players looked after their groins. So don't be as stupid as old cricketers. Protect your computer now. NordVPN is the protection I use when facing cyber shortballs or when rights issues try to dismiss me. Geo-block so you can watch all the cricket you want. Grab your NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/Kimber.
Ankush says, what are the most common ways in which administrators and players are involved in cheating in the current system? Is match fixing common? Ball tampering? Ball tampering has been forever in cricket. So yes, that's always happening. Can India versus Pakistan, Australia versus England in ICC tournaments be considered a form of cheating? I think it's a form of fixing the schedules. I've said that many times before. No, there's certainly a lot of match fixing still going on. It doesn't seem to be happening as much in major international cricket at the moment. We've just started to have it hit women's cricket, so that's going to be the next big challenge because women don't get paid a lot. I think there's some problems certainly with associate cricket, and there's some problems with a lot of this crap franchise cricket when it comes to match fixing. So yeah, there's certainly a lot going on at any one time in cricket, sadly. It's a very, 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 extremely, very poorly run sport. Person says, thoughts on the USA women's team losing ODI status? They just split a two-match series with Zimbabwe women, so it feels like a strange decision to lose status. Congrats on the Nuggets advancing. Yeah, I think they have all these committees. They have the ICC committee, the MCC committee, and they all talk about weird things like, oh, you know, maybe we should allow saliva back in the ball. I don't care. I don't think the statuses as they currently are granted. I don't think there should be statuses in cricket. The USA have 11 women who want to play a 50-over game against another country. That's an international game, right? Whether you want to call it first tier, second tier, third tier, that is a perfectly respectable thing for a sport to do. So taking away statuses to begin with just is silly for me. But if you're going to do it, again, wouldn't you do it in a much more professional way? And who's made that decision? Where's the integrity? Can we have a look at it? Was it cricket people? Was it data related? Was it just based on their record? Was it just because they don't look very good at the moment? Like, it, that sort of thing really, really irritates me a lot. But yeah, some people might say that cricket is a very, 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 extremely, very poorly run sport. All right. Let us get to the super chats. And then we can knock it off for the day. Oh, we've only got a couple of super chats. Oh, can't find them. Question is in the chat. Okay. Hoping I can find it. Bart881 says, to honor the insanely competitive playoffs, who would cricket's equivalent of the following players be based on skill and narrative arcs? Joker, Ant-Man, Tatum, and Curry. So someone's asked me about this before. Joker, God, I don't know if we have a Joker in cricket. It's a really good question. And I'm just not sure that we have a player like that. Because you'd almost need someone who's like Dhoni's brain, but you'd want them to be an even better batter than Dhoni. Like with Virat's ODI batting or something. I don't know. I don't know if that's a great one. I'm trying to think of someone else. I just don't know if we have a Joker. Ant-Man, I mean, maybe Sky? Is Sky a good Ant-Man? I suppose Ant-Man is a little bit younger. But Sky comes to mind for him. Tatum. Tatum's a really interesting one because you're looking at a cricketer who would need to be very good all round, but probably not elite at anything, but still. So would that be like, I don't know, maybe a Jadeja in a one-day game? Well, yeah, it's very easy to either not give them any credit or give them way too much credit, right? Like, I wonder if that's who Tatum would be. Curry, I suppose you're looking at someone like Andre Russell for Curry, right? Although it's been easier to copy on Steph Curry than it has been to copy Dre Russ. But yeah, I would think it would be a six-hitter because you're literally changing the mass of cricket at that point, right? Like, I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. I suppose at the moment, maybe it's Puran, actually, is it, but he's not as good as Curry. But yeah, like you're changing the mass because of the way that you score, right? And it's always going to be that way for everyone. The scene uploader says, why haven't we seen more T20 examples of the Narayan as opener phenomenon? Okay, so here's the reason. Flawed batters, when they go up the order, are usually exposed quicker. So we had a whole wave of this in the 90s, and we eventually basically stopped doing it. The people who worked were generally frontline batters, right? Who are maybe more suited to hitting the brand new ball. So I don't know, Mark War, Sanesh Jayasuriya, Mark Greatbatch, those sorts of players. But, you know, Sanesh Jayasuriya's batting opening partner eventually had to be replaced because he couldn't make any runs anymore, right? Kalu Witharana, Junior Murray, Ian Healy, Craig McDermott, Pat Simcox, Jason Gillespie. There was some random pinch hitters back in those days. And they didn't last because for two reasons. One, you send someone up the order to slog, and if they're not very good, there's a chance they'll miss the ball 10 times in a row. And that happened heaps. Secondly, as I said before, if you're sending them up the order, that means they have to face the best bowlers who are now fit and untired with a brand new ball. It is a hard time to bat if you are not a specialist batter. Sunil Narine has a remarkable skill set. David Willey has made a very good career out of it. two players I always thought would be interesting were Adil Rashid when he was younger and was a better bat, and Rashid Khan, who you mentioned here as well. I just don't think Rashid Khan wants to face the new ball. Darren Sammy is someone I think would have been fascinating, but clearly he didn't want to face the new ball either, right? A little bit more of a traditional batter than the other guys we've mentioned, but still, I suppose Darren Sammy and Adil Rashid are quite similar when you drill down on it. But Darren Sammy went on to be a much better white ball player. But Adil Rashid probably has more conventional runs. Anyway, I don't know why I got into that wormhole. But I would assume that those guys just don't think they have the skills to be able to do it against the new ball. Secondly, you talk about what the trade-off is. So part of the trade-off is quite often running between wickets, because they're all often not very good at running between wickets. Another trade-off is the dot ball thing. And Sun on the Run's pretty good at this, not getting caught. But a lot of pinch hitters get caught and just can't hit the ball for 10 balls in a row. And then the third one is that you are generally going to average quite low, 15 to 18, right? I don't know what, I wonder what David Willey's overall batting average is in T20 cricket. I feel like it should be a little bit higher than that, 18 to 19. No. Okay. So T20 internationals, he averages 15, and T20s, he averages 22, right? So if you look at that by competition, when he plays as a franchise player, PSL, he averages 10 with the bat, IL, he averages 17. 100 is 19, IPL 26, but didn't make many runs in that one, and the BBL 14. So if you set him up to open the batting, right, he's probably only going to last half the time of a regular opener, which means that you've opened up an end. And in some cases, Akshar Patel, Ashwin, Narine, that can actually help, right? And in some cases, that doesn't help, and it doesn't really give you a big boost. And lastly, it's one of the reasons that these guys don't bat at the top of the order is because they are limited. Generally, you need the right kind of... and Narine's changed himself a little bit. But I think with David Willey, you don't want to send David Willey into open all the time, because I don't think it would always suit his game. You get players who are great at hitting finger spin or wrist spin or spin that spins into them or spin that spins away or right arm seam. Like, you could use Shardul Thakur. If you knew that the opposition was going to use three right arm seamers and have the field up, I reckon you could use Shardul Thakur in that power play, right? I'm not sure you want to use him when they're spin being bowled. But my memory, I haven't looked at his numbers in a while, is he struggles a lot more against spin. You might find that he can't hit left armers, right? There was a time, and I don't think it's still the case, where Sun on Run, I think, was struggling against left arm seam, for instance. So you could kind of load up on left arm seam when he was there, because he's more limited. So there's heaps of drawbacks. But the biggest one is that everyone remembers the success of pinch hitters, and everyone forgets the time that they make two off nine, right? And they become a real drain to your side. Last super chat is from Anmol, who says, shouldn't RR and CSK give up on this cycle and trade aging players like Jadeja, Ashwin, Sampson, and Sandeep for young talent for the next cycle? I've thought more about CSK. Yeah, it depends on how many players you can keep for the next cycle. It's part of the problem there, Anmol. But yes, what would you get for... I don't even know who they would trade. They're not going to be able to trade Dhoni. Would they be able to trade Ashwin? Would they want to trade Jadeja? Like, there isn't really a replacement for Jadeja out there. Could you trade Jadeja for Washington Sundar? I don't know. That's an interesting one. That I would be interested in. How many more years is Jadeja going to play for? What if he plays for six more years? You're in a bit of an issue there if you do that. But yeah, I do think teams need to be a little bit smarter in this. And, what you want to do is you want to find... Lucknow could be a good one for this, right? Lucknow, KKR, Sunrisers, right? Teams who probably think they should have done better this year or were pushing for playoffs or whatever that may be. And you play on that. And you're like, you know, if you got Ashwin or you got Sampson or whatever that may be, or whoever the player is, don't think you'd trade Sampson at his age. Sanju Sampson age. I just want to make sure. Yeah, he's 30. I don't think you want to trade him at 30 unless you're completely saying that he's going to be done at 33, 34. But yeah, some of those guys, I think you could certainly make a case for that. You have to prey on other teams' sensibilities a little bit, but that's what trading is at a certain point. I think CSK have an interesting core. I think Rajasthan have obviously some nice pieces, but I don't know if their core is quite as interesting to me. And maybe you could trade around the edges of that core and, as you say, go all in on a younger side. But then the owners, the thing with the IPL is it doesn't take, it only takes maybe one or two players next year to catch fire and maybe the pitches to spin again for CSK to be a good team. Do you want to pivot away from your strength in order to follow that? I think it's a really tough decision. It's very easy for us to say, if I own a franchise, I mean, I would probably still do it because that's how I think about things. But you can imagine why they may not want to do that, right? So we're not at that. I don't think we're at that all-in rebuild situation for a successful team. Maybe it's easier for Rajasthan because I haven't had as much success as CSK, but I don't know. Anyway, that was a really good super chat. There were some very good questions all the way through that show, as always. We'll be back later in the week with all sorts of other things as well. If you haven't seen the latest Kimapa, go and see that. We're working on some features for the IPL coming up in the next week or so. So, I don't know, have a look at those. Just, I don't know, follow stuff, subscribe to stuff. Do all the things that you should do, and I'll see you again next time.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.